All right, good afternoon, everyone. Quick plug, we are having our business meeting for urban and anthropogenic soils after today's symposium, so I encourage you all to stick around afterwards. My name is Bryant Scherenbrock. I am a professor of soil science at University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, and I'm also a research fellow at the Morton Arboretum. And I'll be talking to you today about some research that we did in Chicago. Before I get into it, I should acknowledge my co-authors, Margaret Balecki, Emma, Bob Fahey, a forest ecologist, and Michelle Catania, who is my research assistant at the Morton Arboretum. So they did a lot of this work, and I thank them. All right. So in putting together this symposium, I wanted to kind of address three things. And I wanted folks to talk about global and regional carbon budgets, and specifically what we know about urban. I wanted to talk about what happens in urban in terms of, you know, respiration flux, sort of dynamics, the turnover of carbon in urban systems. And the last kind of symposium topical area that we wanted to focus in on was soil carbon management and ecosystem services that come along with managing carbon. My talk today is going to focus specifically on the first bullet point, the global and regional carbon budgets, because I think right now we're at the point we really got to have a better understanding of what's actually there. And these things that were brought up after Dr. Lal's talk about depth, you'll see I'll provide some data on that I think I hope will be interesting for you guys. All right. So what do we know? How much carbon do we know is in urban systems? And what do you guys think? I see a lot of UW Stevens Point students here, so I might call on you guys if we don't get some audience participation. Do we have a lot of carbon in urban systems? So right here, I got a bunch of data from the literature here, and you can see these are all shallow depths. So this data right here is just kind of the surface stuff. Is there a lot? Well, there's a decent amount actually in just the surface area. So we're talking about 3 to 23 or so kilograms per square meter. And to put that in perspective, that's the amount of carbon in maybe like our alpha sols, our forest soils, down to a meter, all the way down to that 23 or so, we're approaching maybe even some gelosols. So just in the surface 10 centimeters of some of the urban systems, what we see in the literature, we have a lot of carbon there. And when we get deeper, we certainly find more carbon. So this study by Joe and McPherson in Chicago in 1995, they estimated they found about 40 kilograms per square meter of carbon. That's a lot. Okay, and then when those studies that have gone down to a meter, what do we see? We again see a big increase, and we see a lot of variability. Okay, so Steve Rossidi recently published a paper, and he found only 2.5 to 16 or so kilograms of carbon per square meter, all the way up to some of the stuff that Rich Yu published back in 2006, 285 kilograms per square meter, and that's histosol. That's a lot of carbon. Okay, so there's a wide range of variability. And I think you'll see that in some of the data that we present. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about the Chicago Urban Forest Study. And this is a study that I've been involved with. This is the Chicago region, the 7-county Chicago region. And there's been a lot of really good ecological work in this area. So there's been 3 very intensive vegetation surveys starting in 1994. There was another one done about 10 years later, and another one done 10 years after that. And with this most recent one, we collected soil data down to a meter. So we have a really cool data set to answer some questions. The question that Daryl brought up, so what is urban? Okay, would you guys say that this 7-county region is urban? I would say. So some folks would define urban as, you know, population density, about 1,000 people per square mile. In that 7-county region, we have about 8 million people, and that works out to about 1,400 people per square mile. And certainly we have a gradient in what we'd call urban. So Cook County is the county right in the center here. I think we have this guy right here. This is our largest county, and very, very urban. But even as we move out here in DuPage, this is quite an urban county as well, too. So when I talk about urban, I'm talking about the 7-county region, and I'm proposing that this entire region is quite urban. And it's not just on population density, but also on land use. Okay? All right, so the objectives of the study, for what I was looking at, were to improve our understanding of soil organic carbon storage. And then we also wanted to take a look at what were the factors that we could use to predict organic carbon storage in this ecosystem. We had a couple of hypotheses. The first one was that we actually thought that the carbon contents in this large ecosystem would meet or exceed other systems, okay? And I'll talk about why we proposed that, but basically there's a lot of coverage on urban soils. They're in Chicago, they're particularly wet, and we add a lot of amendments to them. And we think that, or we thought going into this, that we would see a lot more carbon deeper. Okay, so we thought that those were assessing just surface soils are missing a lot of carbon. We thought that spatial patterns would be explained by anthropogenic factors, and we didn't think the traditional Hanseian approach, climate organisms, relief parent material and time, would be appropriate for predicting carbon storage in this ecosystem. We thought there was other things that are important. All right, so what do we do? Okay, so this is our plot system. So we measured about 190 plots. So these are randomly located plots based on land use and also stratified by county. Okay, and we have five major land uses. And then each one of those land uses, we have tree and non-tree plots because we wanted to look at the influence, the potential influence of vegetation and particularly woody vegetation on soil organic carbon. And I'll talk a little bit about what these abbreviations are. So our first land use is commercial, industrial, transportation, utility, and vacant lands. So these are our most urbanized plots, and we lump these all together and highly urbanized. Okay, we looked at residential lands, and this would include a lot like this, and also our high-density residential lands, but lands where people were living in those soils, on those soils, excuse me. Parklands. Parklands included a park like this, but they also included institutional lands and golf courses. Forest lands. This is an example of a nice forest in Chicago. They don't all look like this. Some of them are actually very nice. Chicago has quite an extensive forest park network. So these are lands that had woody vegetation on them. And agricultural lands. And remember, we had agricultural lands with crops on them, and we also had agricultural lands that no longer had crops and now have woody vegetation. Major crops in the area are corn and soybeans. Okay, so each one of those plots, we had a plot that looked like this, where we had a larger area where we measured all the vegetation components, and then we did our soil sampling on a 5-meter radius. We took two deep soil cores down to a meter, and we collected surface samples as well on that plot. We looked at litter sampling as well, too. And I got some pictures. So there's Emma and Corinne. There's two of the students that worked on this project, and they did all the vegetation stuff. So they measured DBH, they did species composition on all the plots, they did some qualitative assessments, they looked at coarse woody debris, snags, all sorts of vegetation stuff. I'm not going to cover a lot of that. They also collected increment cores on each one of the trees, so we got growth estimates on these plots. There's Emma collecting an increment core. There's Miles Sachs. He's a student now at Cornell working on a PhD, and he worked to collect a lot of the soil data, and here he's working to collecting the litter sample, litter layer. Collect our surface soils, and we collected subsoils soils down to a meter with this handy-dandy contraption. So this is a JMC sampler. It pounds the core down to a meter and extracts it, and it's somewhat undisturbed. And it works okay. I think, Susan, you probably would have something different to say about that, right?
No.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. So it's nice because you can take it with you can haul it places that we couldn't get to with a Giddings rig or such, but it does have some problems. Okay, so the cores were collected. The rough boundaries were delineated in the field by Miles and some other students, and then all the cores were brought back to the laboratory, and I delineated all the horizons myself. Afterwards, we did some other stuff with them. For each one of the horizons, we did color, structure, texture, bulk density, soil organic carbon, nitrogen, pH, and electrical conductivity, and we had a total of 1,293 horizons that were sampled. And then on the surface soils, we did chemical, physical stuff, and biological stuff, because we're going to use that to answer a modeling question. Can we use the surface soil information to predict what's deep down? And then we had a whole bunch of litter samples. So far, we have depth, mass, and we're still working on invertebrates for these guys. Statistical stuff, these are just the tools that we used to do some of the modeling. We did typical regression. We did some principal component analysis. I'm still working on the structural equation modeling, so I'm not going to present that now. All right, so what do we find? So first, this question, how does soil organic carbon vary with depth in Chicagoland soils? Okay, and this is how it varies. Okay, and to answer our first question, Are we missing the boat when we're just focusing on the top 25 centimeters? Yes. We're missing a lot of carbon. We're missing, you know, at least 75% or so is below that 20 centimeters or so. Okay? And you can see even a meter down, we could be missing a lot of that carbon, right? So we modeled this, and this suggests that we need to go down maybe to 2 meters. So we had a lot of carbon down there. And why? Okay, so to compute the density of carbon, this is kilograms per square meter, we take the percentage, so the organic carbon percentage, and this is what most people would focus in on, the percentage of carbon and what you often see published in the literature. And yeah, this is typically what you see. You get your highest percentage of carbon up in your topsoil, right? And we also had pretty high percentages of carbon even in our lower layers. But the other part of that story is density, right? So many of our urban soils are pretty dense deep down, and because of, to get that kilograms per square meter, you have to include the bulk density assessment with that, right? And we saw that increase quite a bit as we go deep down. Okay. All right. So we concluded that yeah, we should be going deeper. 0 to 25 is probably not deep enough if we want to fully estimate the soil organic carbon stock. We could be missing up to 75%, and I think we need to even go deeper than what we did. That's difficult and challenging, of course. And then with that deeper carbon is also what? More protected, more physically and likely also more chemically protected from decomposition. Okay, so how much soil organic carbon is in Chicagoland soils was the next question. So this is a histogram of our data. We found a mean carbon content of 36 kilograms per square meter. We saw a range from 4 all the way up to 132, so a very large range and generally pretty high contents. If we want to compare those contents to other soils across the world, so this is some data from Urswarn soil orders and carbon contents soil orders, we can see that our study, we put our carbon contents pretty similar to what Chelisol's are. So frozen, cold soils, very low decomposition, store a lot of carbon, pretty high. But we're in terms of our variability, we could be approaching, some of our sites could be approaching histosols, but for the most part, we're underneath them. And then to compare that to those other urban studies that have looked at deep soil carbon, we're at the lower end. So we didn't, our mean values didn't approach what Rich, you've seen in a bunch of other cities, but we were higher or pretty similar to Washington and Hong Kong or so. But again, we had a lot of variability in ours. Okay, and then to put our numbers in a little bit of a context, okay? So the total Chicagoland area is 14,625 kilometers squared. And if we're to extrapolate our mean over this entire area, we get about 0.5 gigatons of carbon. Okay? And that works out to about 2.5% of the entire gigaton carbon stock in the United States urban pool. Okay, so Chicagoland represents a pretty good chunk of total urban land soil organic carbon. You can see that these are the counties down here. Cook County had our largest contribution, and that was a result of we did have more carbon in that county, but it's also our largest county area-wise. And then to kind of compare that with the anthropogenic emissions, Chicago has 8 million people, and if we assume that each of those people, we have about a ton or 6 tons of carbon per person per year, this is the anthropogenic emissions. And so our soil organic carbon stock is about 10 times what each person would emit per year. Okay, so it's a decent amount of carbon in the soil, and it's a stock that if it were disturbed would certainly be important in the anthropogenic emission scenario. Okay, so what we concluded from that was that we think that, yes, so Chicagoland's SOC, we have more than other ecosystems and a lot of variation. And we do think that it's a significant amount and needs to probably be considered in terms of global regional budgetings. Okay? So is SOC a function of soil forming factors? All right, so here we're using our plot data. So this is our soil organic carbon contents in each one of those 190 plots. And we wanted to see how if there's data that we could use to predict the carbon stocks. And we took the, you know, Hanziani's soil forming factors approach, climate, organisms, relief, parent material, and time. And we found a bunch of factors that would relate those information. So we looked at the position on the landscape, the moisture content of the soil to relate climate. We looked at a whole bunch of vegetation factors like the basal area, the litter depth, to relate organisms. This, we had some parent material things like the type of moraine or the thickness of the drift. And we had a lot of other factors. How successful do you think we were in doing this? Do you think we were able to predict organic carbon storage with these factors? Not at all. Very, very unsuccessful. Okay? And I'll just go through organisms and just walk through some of the data. So organism, we thought, okay, if there's going to be one of the soil forming factors that are going to be useful, it's going to be organisms. It's going to be the trees. That's, we set up the experiment to test that, okay? So we had half our plots were tree plots, and the other half were no tree plots, and we saw no differences in tree versus no tree in our soil organic carbon storage. And I thought, okay, well, maybe if we looked at it by depth, is there something different? So here's our organic carbon storage stratified by topsoil and by subsoil, and still no differences. No influence on the tree. Okay, so maybe tree, no trees, no good. Let's look at basal area on the plots. There's no relationship between basal area and soil organic carbon storage. So that was kind of a bummer. We looked at litter depth. So maybe the trees weren't telling us, but maybe what they put on the litter was giving a signature. And again, we saw no relationship with our soil organic carbon storage with litter. So that tells us that organisms really probably, the data that we tested, we weren't able to, were not very useful predicting soil organic carbon storage. And the same sort of thing applied to all of these things that we tested under climate, under relief, under parent material and time. So what is important? What do you guys think? What might be useful for predicting carbon storage in urban areas? If these things aren't, is there something that is?
Anthropogenic.
So let's look back at organisms and let's look at us. So that's what we did. So this shows us our carbon storage stratified by our different land uses. Okay, so we have our agriculture, we have our most urban, we have forest, park, residential. And we saw a significant differences based on land use. Okay, so this tells us, yeah, okay, humans are important and land use is important for stratifying the data. Okay, then we looked a little bit further. So what particular pools of organic carbon might be most influenced by land use? And we found that we really saw a significant increase in our subsoil carbon contents with our most urbanized plots. Okay, and that's important. We looked at a bunch of other factors. This is one of them, impervious surface area. And it's not a really strong regression. It is significant, but an R-squared of only 0.114. And this tells us that the more impervious surface area, the higher organic carbon contents we saw. Yeah?
Are those under impervious?
So to get this value, what we did from each point center, we extrapolated 30 meters in radius, and we characterized the impervious surface area from that plot center. So not all of them were. When we went out to a plot, we picked an area that best represented that plot. If the whole plot was underneath impervious surface there, then we had to find a way to get underneath there, and that only happened on a few of them.
Okay.
Another anthropogenic factor that was very useful in predicting distance from Navy Pier. So if Chicago's set up kind of neat, so any way you move from Navy Pier, you get less urbanized. Okay, our most urban areas right there at Navy Pier, and in all directions we have less urbanization. Okay, so this metric allowed us to get a significant relationship with organic carbon storage. Again, not very strong. So can we model urban soil organic carbon? I think we can, but I think we have to look at, and we actually did, we have to look at urban factors, but we also had to pull in a lot of our surface soil properties. Okay, so this is a global model. So this is taking all the soil stuff we measured, all the climate, organisms, relief, parent material, time, and the anthropogenic factors, throwing them into a batch and asking the stats program to tell us what's most important. And this is across all of our plots. And across all of our plots, we were able to produce a decent model knowing the carbon content of the top 25 centimeters, the pH, and then also including some soil properties like sodium, potassium, slope, impervious surface area, particular organic matter, loss of ignition, organic matter, and conductivity. We got a decent model across all the plots. But the anthropogenic factors are so important that we wanted to say, okay, should we look at them within land uses? Because I think we can get better models. And indeed, we do. So when we split up our modeling by our different land uses, we get a pretty good model here, so 0.734 R squared. But the things that are important within each one of those land uses are different. Okay, so for instance, our most urbanized land use, the commercial, industrial, transportation, utility, and vacant, elevation, sodium content, and carbon topsoil were the most important, and we had a whole bunch of other factors like aggregate stability, impervious surface area that were also very important. But it gave us a pretty darn good line then. But it differed by land use. So, for example, residential, these were the factors that were important in that. Okay, so right now we're at the stage of trying to figure out why this certain set of properties are important for residential, why this certain set of properties might be important for our most urban areas. Okay, so I don't have any conclusive answers for you there. But what we think so far is, yes, anthropogenic factors are very important. We need to account for them in doing our soil organic carbon estimates. And we also think that we need to include some topsoil characteristics. We can't get any detail without it. The next steps for us is we're going to be using some soil models. So we're going to be using the Century model, Rossi, other soil carbon models, and seeing if we can apply that to our data set to see if those other models can predict the carbon storage contents on these. We also want to explore different data layers, different remote data layers like LiDAR data sets. And we hope to build a model with a GIS, something like this, where we can pull different layers like land use, roads, impervious, land cover, soil survey data, LIDAR, plop that all together, and make a nice map like this. So this is a map just using a Kriging function in our plot data, and it illustrates nicely. We saw our highest density of carbon right here. And in the urbanized pockets within the 7-county region, you can see we have higher concentrations. This is in the west suburbs and north suburbs. Okay, so this project was funded by USDA Forest Service grant, so I thank them and acknowledge them under the NUCVAC program. I thank University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, the Morton Arboretum, and all of the folks that worked on here, my co-authors, all the students that helped out, and I think I have time for questions. You can go to this website and get this information as well, too. So, yes, sir?
We've worked quite a bit now on white carbon in urban soils, and in the northeast of England, the carbon concentration has got up to about 75 kilograms per meter. A large proportion of that is soot. And I wondered whether that might be a factor which might be explaining some of your patterns. Particularly your sites that are close to transport links and also your regional patterns in relation to the centre of suburbanisation.
So I got some cool pictures in here too. We got time for look at pictures, I think, right? I'll answer the question and show you pictures too. So the soils kind of fell into three batches: natural soils, alpha soils, model soils. Those are nice pictures of alpha soils, model soils. Disturbed natural soils, so those are alpha soils, model soils that were ripped up and changed. And then we had my favorite group, the urban soils, that were all over the place. And we saw a bunch of soils that, right here, so this is all black carbon stuff. I mean, really recalcitrant stuff, very deep and very high concentrations. So right here, obnoxious concentrations, so down to, 70 centimeters or so, what would be classified as, a huge mollic epipenon, really cool soils. Certainly, I do think that there's a lot of really resistant carbon buried deep down. And one thing we're going to be doing with this data is then also partitioning the organic carbon pools to look at how much recalcitrant carbon is there by depth. Yeah?
Have you seen any, or has anybody looked at any difference in terms of microbial decomposition and respiration rates between urban and
Sure. Yeah. There's quite a bit of work done on respiration in urban versus non-urban, and a lot of that work's been done on the gradient studies. I mean, Rich, you've done a bunch of that, or you've been involved with that, right? And I think generally, correct me if I'm wrong, we tend to see more respiration in our urban systems. Correct?
I'll show some data.
Yeah. I mean, And for a variety of reasons, I mean, we're putting more management into those systems. They could be watered more. They could have a larger substrate pool, which is some of the stuff that we found, yeah. Yeah?
So you've really had some high numbers here.
Mm-hmm.
And I can understand where you have a black carbon or inorganic carbon component like mm-hmm. this, why they would be really high. But you, across the board, were getting pretty high numbers. How do you explain that?
You know, I went through, yeah, and we corrected for inorganic carbon as well, too.
So you did?
Yeah, yeah, we did. Oh, yeah, yep, yep.
So carbonates.
Exactly, yeah. So anything over pH 7, we ran it twice and did it to get rid of the inorganic carbon as well, too. So if you take a look at the natural soils in this area, They're quite high. So there's a mollusol there
and
there was a lot of mollusols that we saw, even within our area. So
you're getting burial, maybe?
Yeah, I think so.
And when you're going down, you're getting those old mollusols.
I think so. And a lot of redox features in the profiles. I mean, I'd say 50% of the profiles I looked at, I could see some redox in there. So they're wet mollusols. I just think that there's in the Chicago region.
So the big numbers you were getting in New York City were basically fly ash.
Yeah.
Stuff like your.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We did have some on the lower end, but definitely our data set skewed to the higher end. Yeah, Susan.
Just wondering what you think about separating out to when you're trying to model urban soil carbon. It almost seems to me like there's two separate systems. You have the ongoing soil management characteristics, plants, whatever, you know, layers. And then you have things like hunks of coal and soot in the soil, and the magnitude of the carbon that's in one sample that pulls up a big chunk of coal is just so radically different. And then the carbon that's there is mediated by all these other things. You
mm-hmm.
know, like
yeah.
It's not mediated by how much you irrigate or fertilize or what kind of plants I grow. And so it almost seems like you've got two systems that are operating next to each other or in the same place, but we shouldn't try to model them together.
No, that's maybe the point I was making wasn't as clear as I liked it to be. I think we have five unique systems and we need to model them separately. So going back over here, that's what we're doing. We're splitting up these five land uses and then asking within agricultural lands, what are the most important factors? And within our urban lands, these are the factors.
But within the land use, you still have, I mean, especially if you're looking at process models, you've got two different kinds of dynamics mm-hmm. going on that may or may not be that related to each other.
I agree, but at some point we have to stratify the landscape, and land use is what most of the data is on, right?
Yeah, it really brought to mind because I just submitted a paper where we were doing maybe just 1 meter cores, and one of the samples had a couple hunks of coal in it, and it just, you know, threw everything off. So we just tossed it as an outlier because of the nature of what we were trying to do. We weren't trying to quantify it.
So we did all the carbon by horizons. By horizons, and then aggregated on the profile as well too.
Right.
So if I only had a chunk of you know 80% carbon in this, that 80% wasn't extrapolated across the whole meter. It was just carbon content for
that
depth.
Area,
yeah. Exactly.
So
yeah.